The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Sorry. So this morning, I thought we would talk about the topic of resolve or determination. The Pali word for that is adhitana. And there are other words that are used. Sometimes people use the word commitment or conviction, or as a more devotional side, it can be also what one is devoted to, adhitana. So I'll use various of those words, but I might sometimes just say the Pali so that you can be aware of all the different aspects. You can choose the one that works for you. So I want to explore a little bit this interesting and foundational quality that we bring to the practice. It's a quality of one's character, one's heart, and it's also a quality that's used as when we're walking the path to liberation. So maybe in a simple sense, we could say that adhitana is the quality of directing the mind toward an aspiration. And it happens that this, where this appears in the teachings, a number of places, but in the list where it appears fairly prominently or most commonly is the list of the paramis, which are 10 qualities. There are 10 paramis in our tradition, which are 10 perfections of the heart or qualities of the character of a person that support the ability to develop wisdom and let go. So they're qualities that can be worked on both on and off the cushion, and they have a lot to do with the strength of our heart. And it happens that this quality resolve, or adhitana, is fairly far along in the sequence. Of course, we don't just start with 1 and get to 10, but it's number 8 out of 10. And interestingly, we won't go through the whole series of the paramis, but the two just before it are patience and truthfulness. So it goes patience, truthfulness, resolve. And I think there's a connection. There's a reason why we get this little sequence within the 10. Is that when we patiently observe the truth of how things are for a long time, if we just keep watching, at some point, we have enough information to formulate an aspiration of some kind. So we start to see, if we patiently observe the truth of how things are, we may begin to notice how things work, that there's suffering, and that there's a cause of it, and that there's a possibility for its ending. And then there becomes an aspiration to walk a path toward that ending. So we formulate some kind of coherent aspiration and we set forth to pursue it. We determine some clear direction and head that way purposefully. But again, lest this start sounding a little bit hard-edged, there's a devotional side to it also. We could equally well say we develop a sacred sense of purpose that arises from deep in our heart and it starts coming forth, being expressed in the world. So pick your avenue, whichever resonates for you is fine. Another way to see resolve is that it's the link between intention and action, right? We might intend to do something, but do we actually do it? We've probably seen in ourselves that we have a lot of intentions that don't quite get acted on, which is fine, but there's some link between them, and resolve is somehow that actual determination to go in the direction that we're intending. It actually has a little bit of mystery to it. I mean, I've positioned it as this little tiny thing between intention and action, but it's actually quite complex and a little mysterious, I think, as we'll see later. So what is it that we resolve upon? You know, we have some formulation of an aspiration after we see how things work. What is it? There isn't just one acceptable determination to make in the world. I mean, in general, we're determining to move away from suffering and toward the end of suffering. So all aspirations, their equality, something like that, spiritual aspirations. But there are so many possible ways to formulate that. It depends, I would say, on our character, the specific context of our situation, and probably where we are on the path also, what it is that we aspire to. And there's some wisdom involved in choosing an aspiration. The aspiration for a person with a lot of energy and zeal is different than that for a person who's more introverted, inward-looking, quiet. The determination of a social activist may be different from the determination of a hospital chaplain, for example. And also the aspirations that we develop early in practice will probably change along the path. So it's not necessarily that if we find our aspiration changing that we were somehow wrong before, you know, just that we've changed because of that first aspiration, and so there's a need to change it, strengthen it, redirect it towards something new. Don't worry if you're not sure what your aspiration is, or if you don't feel like you're wise enough to choose a good one. Say, oh my gosh, she said there was wisdom involved in choosing an aspiration. That's not going to work for me. Don't worry. Whatever amount of wisdom you have at this time is completely sufficient for being able to take the next step. And then whatever wisdom you gain from that will help refine it farther along. There's always a path for us to go forward. It may be useful to know that there actually are. I've been very broad and general, and I think that's good to approach aspiration as something that we can have some breadth of choice about. But there are several specific aspirations that are offered in the suttas, in the written teachings, and also in the later commentaries. They tend to be a little different. In the earliest teachings, there are said to be four resolves, main resolves. The resolve for wisdom, for truth, for relinquishment or generosity, and for peace. Pretty good. And then in the more modern traditions, like in the Burmese tradition, for example, it's said that one should resolve on the seven factors of awakening, which are mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. You don't have to remember all of those. And also the paramis. Resolve is one of the paramis, the eighth, but it was certainly needed all along the way to determine to develop the other nine of the paramis. One of those is generosity, for example, so one could determine to be more generous. And one is ethical behavior, so one could resolve on not doing harm. We could resolve to bring energy or patience or truthfulness to our practice. Notice that all of these things are quite beautiful and lofty. I hope you don't feel shy about having beautiful, lofty aspirations. You know, oh, I can't resolve for peace. That's way, way beyond what I could imagine. Or, my goodness, concentration or patience. But why not? Why not? This is something that we look toward and provides a direction. But on the other hand, if we're not feeling lofty at this moment, very everyday sounding aspirations are actually just as meaningful along our path. In fact, they might be the bulk of the path, is the smaller ones that we make. I'm going to determine not to overeat at lunch, you know? It's an actual determination that we can make and follow through on. Or something larger, I'm going to quit smoking, something like that. Or not to interrupt people so often when we're talking with them, if we notice that that's a habit of ours. We can be devoted to relaxing our body in all situations. I actually did this for about 2 years of my practice. My main kind of most continuous thing that I paid attention to was how tense I was physically. This was important because I was really tense when I started practice. I was rigid in some ways, and it was a big effort for me slowly over time to notice where I was holding my legs, my back, my neck, something, and notice that it was there, try to relax, eventually start to see when it came on. You know, when does that start? How does that start? How can it be let go of? So it's a very simple determination, the determination to relax physically, but just doing it over and over again, step by step, had an effect over time that was important. This is how the paramis work, actually, is that it's these very simple actions we do throughout the day, on the cushion and throughout our daily life, that provide, over time, this critical infrastructure of strength in our heart that then serves us in deep ways and in broad ways in situations where that aren't as everyday or that come up surprisingly, that will be there for us. These qualities that we develop will be there for us. So you might take a moment right now to consider what it is that you're currently resolved upon or would like to be. What's meaningful to develop at this time? What is your intention that you might be willing to act on? And are you willing to put in some effort to pursue it? So as we explore and become interested in Adhidhamma, we probably begin to recognize that partial or half-hearted commitment to the path was not going to be sufficient in the long run. A Zen teacher says, no matter how much we have studied or how many ideas we may have, without exertion, our understanding will be superficial, not transformative. So Adhidhamma, this quality, gives us kind of a little oomph to our practice that allows us to make some kind of genuine exertion. And I'm going to talk about what exertion means. That might be a dangerous word to use. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. So as is often true, though, I want to start first with the obstacles to Adhidhamma. So often we have to explore something in Buddhism by noticing what prevents it from happening. You know, we want to develop loving kindness and we sit down to do metta practice, and what happens? All of our ill will shows up. Why? Because this is how the human mind works. When it decides for loving kindness, it has to run into what isn't loving kindness. Unfortunately, or actually fortunately, but people think it's unfortunate, is that this is a very nitty-gritty path that we spend a lot of time dealing with the obstacles. And in fact, if we just remove all the obstacles to freedom, then what's left is the freedom. That's how it works. So in this case, what we're exploring are the hindrances to having Adhidhamma. What hinders our ability to make some kind of determination and pursue it? So there are external and internal barriers, I think. There are external ones actually from our society that come in. We may, in some cases, we live in a society where we think that things should come easily and quickly. And the teachings, it happens, are quite readily available to us, which is wonderful and good. And in some cases, provides a barrier to making strong determination. This is a quote from a Tibetan nun. In past ages, spiritual aspirants underwent difficulty to meet teachers. Tibetans traversed the high Himalayas to meet wise mentors in India. Chinese crossed the Taklamakan Desert and Karakoram Mountains to attend monasteries and bring back scriptures from India. But we have different expectations. We think, why should we have to travel to attend teachings? We have jobs, families, such busy lives. We don't have time to cross town, let alone go to another continent. Forgetting that the seeker's very effort and struggle open him or her to the teachings, we resent that our spiritual practice should impinge upon our preferences. I don't know that that's always true, but I stated it a little bit provocatively to see if that challenge might sometimes arise in our heart. It's a little voice that can sound very wise, at, you know, whispering in our ear, oh, don't make that much effort. But more often, the problems actually come internally from our own heart. Any of the five hindrances can be a problem to setting an aspiration. So you may know this list: the sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and doubt. And also fear, I would add. So for example, consider doubt. We might wonder if all this striving is really good for us. We might worry that we don't have sufficient wisdom yet to know what to strive for. All of this doubt comes masquerading as wisdom and sounds logical. But it turns out that there's kind of an Aikido move we can do with any of these hindrances to, you know, to actually doing our practice. So we could resolve not to be caught by the hindrances, for example. I found this very helpful, actually. There is one specific practice you could do right away that will strengthen both adhidhamma and wisdom and weaken the hindrance of desire. So this is, Gil has talked about this, it's called riding out a desire. Notice sometime when you really want something, like a snack, something you don't really need, but you really want it. You're sitting at the computer and you really want that. And then if you notice that that's the desire before you go to the refrigerator, it's possible to take that time as an experiment and say, okay, I'm not going to fulfill that desire, that wanting. I'm not going to give in to that at this moment. And then you just wait. And interestingly, the mind, it might just drop it. So don't expect anything in particular. If you deny a want, the mind might just say, all right, I didn't really want that. Or it might actually have been very attached to the idea of that snack, and you might actually have some protest happen. And it can happen when riding out a desire that you even shake or sweat, or, you know, you realize, oh my gosh, this is really a strong force in me. And it may be really hard for a while. But eventually, that desire will end, even if it's not fulfilled. And that is wisdom. That gives us the reward of wisdom that says that, that we notice that desire will end by itself, and that it's actually hugely peaceful when that desire ends, probably more so than if we were actually to get that snack. The desire would end at the, because of that also. But we would be fooled into thinking that it ended because we fulfilled it. You know, that was the main thing to gain there. So with resolve, we're able to ride out a desire like that and gain that wisdom. In a way, resolve is the vehicle toward learning the deeper lessons that we wouldn't learn if we were just following our preferences all the time. And after you've ridden out that desire, you can go get the snack, by the way. The point isn't not to eat. So if you're hungry, that's okay. But it's nice for the desire for it to end first. Then maybe you won't. You can make a different decision. So in general, these hindrances aren't to be struggled against necessarily, but more like dissolved, you know, ridden out. Just wait. Notice that I didn't say you should sit there and grit your teeth and say, no, 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 I hate this idea that I want to have a snack, it's terrible, it's bad. No, it was just being with it without fulfilling it. So interestingly, resolve and dissolve come from the same root. So maybe you see a softer side of this word resolve now, is that it's a resolve to, yes, to make a determination. But by resolving to just stand still, we can wait for things to dissolve. It's the same effect. So there's what we're working toward, and then there's how we go about pursuing it. So that's what I want to turn toward. how do we go about fulfilling an aspiration if we've decided that we have one? And I think I've started to suggest it. You know, it's not about fighting against things. It's more about learning how to work with them. Now, it is important to have the classical example here. So I'll start with the Buddha. By his words and example, the Buddha definitely advocated strenuous effort in the written teachings. He said, for example, the idler who does not strive, who, though young and strong, is full of sloth, who is weak in resolution, that lazy and idle person will not find the way to wisdom, the way to enlightenment. And the Buddha's own resolution, recorded this way, willingly let only my skin, sinews, and bones remain, and let the flesh and blood dry up in my body, but I will not relax my energy so long as I have not attained what can be attained by human strength, energy, and exertion. And he goes on to say that his disciples should do the same. So, taking this teaching literally may not be helpful in our modern goal-oriented world. So this is what it says, but we know the reality is that many people in our society are pushing too hard. They're pushing physically, damaging their bodies. They're pushing psychologically, creating mental stress. Because of this, I think many Western teachers actually emphasize a path of relaxation and letting go, successively disengaging from all of our neurotic drivenness. Gill has even said that drivenness could be a possible translation of dukkha, which is also translated as suffering or struggle. He says drivenness is pretty good. So this is a very good path, the path of relaxing and letting go for overachievers and workaholics. But it is useful to know then that the Buddha also offered some guidance along these lines. So he himself practiced austerities for 7 years before realizing that it was not the correct path. It did not lead him to enlightenment, to starve himself, freeze himself, exert in ways that were strenuous, you know, clamping down and refusing to breathe, for example. These kinds of things, he did all these because there were people at the time that believed that dominating the physical body was the way to eliminate defilement in the mind. And he discovered that was not true. Not true. He wasn't any wiser after doing all of that. And he was starving and cold and skinny. So he only, at that point, he remembered a time from his childhood when he was happy, relaxed, content, and aware. And he actually entered a state of concentration as a child while sitting under a tree. And he realized that that is the path. It's the middle way between extreme austerities that deny the body and sensual indulgence that's about pampering the body, basically. So what we need is something similar. We need maybe correct aditana, which is striving in a way that's not harmful. How can we strive in a way that is not harmful? So how do we do that? I like this idea because this alone is a huge exploration of our mind. You know, if we have a determination, you know, what I've been doing in my life so far hasn't really worked. That's why I'm here at IMC. Something's got to be better than what I've been doing. But we want to do it in the right way. We're going to have to learn about our mind. How do we be strong, determined, and wise? So it's said that the 10 paramis become perfections when they're combined with wisdom and with compassion. So all the beautiful qualities that we're resolving upon, peace, wisdom, generosity, the 7 factors of awakening, as well as resolve itself, are best done with a combination of using them wisely and using them compassionately, with compassion for ourselves. So it's not just nose to the grindstone. We have to learn about our mind so that we can resist all of its unwholesome impulses and develop its wholesomeness and its strength. So yes, it takes effort, but it's joyful effort. It's hard, but it's hard in a good way. So how does Adhidhana manifest along our path of practice? I think exploring resolve is itself a form of the path. I've found in my own practice that just learning about how my mind aspires to something and then how it tackles that, how it gets hindered by that, how it maybe finally partially achieves that and then realizes refinement is needed, that process of refining intention and refining the energy working towards intention is, in a way, the path. So I would say that this could be framed as Adhidhana that is conscious and intentional and Adhidhana that is not. So starting with the conscious and intentional Adhidhana or resolve that we bring to our path, this is patient ongoing practice. This is a lot of what we do. Just sit 30 minutes a day. Just do the metta phrases. Just come to IMC every week. Just repeat these wholesome actions. Just bring the mind back when it's distracted. Just remember, oh yes, that's right, I'm here. Just relax the body again and again. Here's a quote from Ajahn Suchito. In the early months of my practice, the mind bounced backwards and forwards, ricocheting between feelings and fantasies, grudges and self-judgment like a ball in a pinball machine. I'd always associated freedom with the ability to move around. Instead, it now felt like freedom was in the still watchfulness. It seemed to be here, but I couldn't locate it. It had no motive and no opinions. It was free of all that. But this freedom seemed dependent on making a resolve. For this reason, I got very keen on making resolutions, firstly to sit for an hour, then longer, then meditate all night. Of course, every day the mind wanders, one loses or gets caught in obsessions, which could mean that every day you fail. But I found that the mind could move through a wave of turmoil, and if it did this, it entered a place of peace that was worth aiming for. That's the way an initial resolve feeds back and forms a path. So what he's saying is that making determinations has a real effect. There's a difference between making that determination but failing at it and never making it. Huge difference. Having that determination there channels, focuses, and shapes our actions, which then affects what we experience, and then it allows us to feed back and refine our intention and have a new set of determinations. The whole thing is kind of bootstrapped. If you've walked this path for a while, you realize it. There's no external force, exactly. It's bootstrapped. We lift ourselves by our own bootstraps. And that moment of moving into action from having a determination is very potent and also a little mysterious. So this is how we can make conscious determinations again and again. Oh yes, I'm remembering now, this is my determination, this is what I'm remembering. And then you forget, and then you come back. And then after a while, it becomes smooth enough that you're not putting so much effort into it, you know, like you've kicked along on the skateboard for a while, and at some point you stop and you just coast. And at that point, you're ready for the next aspiration. You know. But over time, I've found that aspiration and determination and resolve move towards something that's less personal. Instead of, I am going to X, that starts getting a little heavy. We start to experience determination that is not coming from the self. So there are mundane examples of this, when our mind kind of gets a mind of its own and we look back later at what we determined to do and how we did it, and we're not quite sure who made that determination. I read a story about a a person whose child was trapped under a car, and they lifted the car. You know, it was the mother. She can't lift a car, but she did at that moment. And looking back, she had no idea how it happened, but this strength and energy to be able to do that was a huge focusing of ability at that moment, forced by what? Her love of her child. Had nothing to do with her personal self saying, I am going to whatever. There's no time for that. So we may have experiences like that in our practice, on the cushion, for example, or in our life, where something clicks, the momentum is unstoppable for a short period of time. This doesn't come from the self. But there's a more profound manifestation of Adhidhana that we come to tap into as the long-term trajectory of our heart along the path to freedom. At some point we realize that we're not doing that. What is it that really that brought you to IMC? The path is continually unfolding in those who practice, often in ways that we can't understand. There's a steady yearning that's not going to exhaust itself until full liberation. We can't do this, but it will be done. It is being done. So here's again from Ajahn Suchito, who quoted earlier about his strong determination, conscious determinations along the early part of his path. He now says, over time, my resolve energy has simplified and calmed to one of sustaining the attitude, may this action or thought be for my welfare, the welfare of others, and lead to peace. It's pretty simple, right? You could carry that anywhere. May this action or thought be for my welfare, the welfare of others, and lead to peace. This resolve doesn't make a self out of intention or results. It just holds experience carefully and lets it pass through and dissolve. This is beautiful and selfless. The self doesn't do it. Parami does. So there at the end he puts in Parami themselves, these 10 qualities, as somehow having their own internal pull. But in case that sounds a little remote or beyond what we were thinking about, I also want to quote some lines from an email that I received from a friend of mine. At the time, he was practicing in Asia, and he wrote back to a group of us, I know you were all moving towards freedom and wisdom in your individual ways, whether seen or unseen, whether in retreat or full catastrophe living. I really trust this process in each of us more than I trust myself. So I think that's the direction that resolve goes. You know, we might initially have a sense of resolve as this drivenness that is actually suffering. And as we come to explore it and open to it and make aspirations and work with them and work with the hindrances that come up, we start to see that there's a mysterious, more devotional, more subtle side of resolve that carries with it this undercurrent of strength, the strength that fuels our practice. It's not so much that we're doing. Resolve is that quiet strength in the heart that's not going to give up. So may your resolve lead to your welfare, the welfare of others, and to peace. There would be time for a couple comments or questions. Thoughts? Yeah. Oh. Thanks. Press it so it's green.
So you had the example from Gill's working with a desire and...
Riding out a desire, yeah.
Running, what is it, running out a desire?
Riding out.
Riding it out. I was wondering about the opposite sort of thing, might be a desire or an aversion, where it actually takes an action rather than passively avoiding satisfying it, where you have some kind of unpleasant duty or chore. What would be the analog there?
Okay, so you're saying that you have some kind of duty that you need to do and responsibility that you need to fulfill, but it is itself unpleasant to you, but you're going to do it anyway. So then, that could take a certain kind of determination to get through. We have to do this many times as humans. We don't certainly don't get to choose to only do the things that we want to do or like to do. So I guess my question back first is, do you have a specific example that you're thinking of, or what is it that you're asking exactly?
Well, my favorite example from this season is taxes.
Ah, it's tax season.
I don't know, I guess in my case I get great anxiety, and I keep putting it off.
Okay, and you feel that you need some determination to get through it, yeah.
Right, and that's much more active
than
just riding out a desire.
Yes, so there you are overcoming in some way a negative mind state. So this is interesting. There are a number of approaches to working with things like this. Often it's helpful to find within that experience aspects of it that are, I don't know if this will be possible, but here's one suggestion, aspects of it that are interesting or pleasant. It might be interesting and satisfying to have that feeling at the end that you finally got to the adjusted gross income on line 48 or whatever it is. It's like, okay, we added that up. Hopefully it's positive. It can also be a time, like you could invite a friend over and have them sit there and help you with it, and then it's a time of bonding with your friend. Or you can bring the wisdom that this is a finite activity, and no matter how difficult it is in the moment, it will end at some point, for sure. And so it's impermanent. So that kind of thing can be helpful. Or physical practices such as relaxing the body. Sometimes anxiety is maintained because we're physically tense and it's actually being locked in that physical tension, and if we release that, then that can help. You could set it up a little schedule for yourself, like I'm going to do 30 minutes on the computer with my taxes, and then I'm going to do 20 minutes of yoga, and then another 30 minutes, and so forth. Something like that. You're nodding slowly. Is any of this starting to land, or is there more? We got to play with our mind sometimes.
Yeah,
it's like a child, right?
So it's
how do you
really
get a child to take a bath when they don't want to?
Much more active.
It's fine to use these kinds of active techniques. And like I said, this is helpful when it's combined with wisdom and compassion. So that's why I suggested the impermanence. But there's also compassion. You know, you can say, this is really hard. You're not the only person who's anxious about filling out those forms. So you can say, wow, this is really challenging. I feel it in a certain place in my body. And that's why I'm going slowly and relaxing and so forth. So just be aware of the compassion that you're bringing and be happy that you can do that.
Yeah, these are things I've tried variously, and I guess the message is I need more resolve.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you're aware of all these. Yeah, and you know, in the end, there are just unpleasant things like this. All right. Thanks, everyone.